When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
The Mueller Report is on Audible. If you've got 19 hours and nothing better to do, you can hear some poor bastard narrate what is essentially a very dry read, but it's an important read. And now that we've had some time to process and read the analysis and get all the hot takes on the Mueller Report, I don't want to spend too much time on it this week, but I believe we'll be spending a lot of time on it going forward as a country. And I'm glad of that in a way, because even though I'm a little disappointed that the Democrats are subpoenaing William Barr instead of Mueller himself, and a lot of talk of, well, let's not rush to impeachment, which might be smart right now, I still maintain Democrats are going to be forced into a box where they're going to have to decide whether or not they move ahead with an impeachment process, or whether they say, no, this is okay, we'll leave it up to the chance of election, which I think is going to reflect very poorly when Democrats go out to voters in 2020 and say, hey, give us more power, we'll do not very much with it, I guess. It's a lesson the Democratic Party has always struggled to learn, and the Obama years honestly didn't help. Don't get me wrong. Obama was a great president, and what Obama did while in office does have a lasting impact, even though a lot of it has been undone by President Trump, and that's what I want to talk about this week, in a way. Not specifically a rehashing of the legislative battles in the Obama years, but the fact that there was so much that Trump could undo as president speaks to, well, what is basically a huge encapsulation of a lot of mini problems that are discussed. That's a bad way to put it, too. These are huge problems, but they're discussed independently by analysts, political scientists, in the media narrative itself. These problems are highlighted, the obstruction of Republicans during the Obama years, up to and including their final biggest move, which was refusing to even discuss the advise and consent obligation the Senate has for a sitting president's SCOTUS nominee. So we all lived that. We all remember that. And the context of this, as it applies to today, impeachment, the Mueller report, the discussion of 2020, the paranoia almost that's out there over polarization and hyper partisanship, the strange fetishization of bipartisanship and centrism and moderation. All of this can be encapsulated in looking back over the obstruction of Republicans through the Obama years, what they got away with, basically, even though there was repudiation on many of these moves in the media. There was a lot of very good faith attempts to inform voters in much of the reporting done that this was very much outside of the norm. Republicans got away with it, honestly. Not only in the electoral cycle did they get away with it, but they got away with it in the mindset of some of the largest voting blocs in the country. That doesn't mean the pass is forever. But it means for the current time, we're operating in an environment where voters said, okay, we think you went too far in some of these situations, but for a variety of reasons, very few of which were actual economic anxiety, we're going to hand the keys to the Republicans anyway. I think this is a challenge for the Democratic Party, and I think that impeachment sometime mid-year is going to be a real existential moment for them. The decision the Democratic Party makes, specifically Democrats in the House, when it comes to impeachment, once they are boxed into that corner, which they will be, and are forced to make a choice, it's really going to matter. Not only for 2020, but for the definition of the party itself. So think of that as a foundation, if you will, for what we're going to talk about this week. And I guess what we're going to talk about this week is you could call this a list of people we should ignore. You could call this a list of parties we should ignore, all of them. Really, what I want to talk about is this idea that Democrats need to build a robust coalition of both minority voting blocs, women, young people, and middle-aged, college-educated, white working-class voters. This idea the easiest way to understand this idea is to begin by understanding who is repeating it most often. And it is almost always a centrist or a self-proclaimed moderate, even a conservative Democrat like Lipinski. You'll see repeating this again and again. Now, part of this is that that's what they have to say. If you're Ben McAdams in Utah, serving your first term, looking at a very aggressive fight in 2020 to get a second term, you're going to have to be hesitant on impeachment. You're going to have to be hesitant on anything that looks like you're just gunning for the president. You're going to have to talk a lot about the importance of bipartisanship. You're going to have to talk a lot about the need to unify and bring people together and the war of ideas between the Republicans and the Democrats. And all of this is built on a history that, well, at one time, we did have two healthy parties, and we had two healthy parties that could get things done. Right now, we're sitting at a moment of extremes, obviously. I mean, look at who's in the White House. But even before Trump's election, we were sitting at a moment of extremes when, yeah, the polarization is pretty robust and has a lot of energy to it. The partisanship is probably no worse than it's always been, but it seems to be driving things a little bit more. Go back to the 1950s, and you had the opposite extreme. So much so, the two parties were indistinguishable. Oftentimes, it was impossible for voters to cast a partisan vote when they wanted to, or to understand what each party stood for. Part of that was because of a realignment that was taking place. Yeah, this is a shock to a lot of Republicans out there. There was a time when both parties held different positions, especially on issues of civil rights, and they did some flipping. Different coalitions were built, and the Republican Party today and the Democratic Party today, very different than the parties of the 1950s. But at the time, legislatively and on non-civil rights policy issues, they were getting a lot done. There was a lot of comedy. There was a lot of kumbaya. There was a lot of back patting and a lot of bipartisanship. And far fewer issues were polarizing and stymied by the gridlock of Congress. That seems to be what, when you listen to a lot of these centrists, and be clear, centrists are not moderates, nor are they independents. Centrism is an ideology. And let's lay the groundwork on this before we dig further. Independents don't really exist. Every time I say this, everyone wants to yell at me. Obviously, they're out there. My point is, when it comes to independents, they are only independent on paper. If you start asking an unaffiliated voter, an independent voter, a third party chaser, what they really believe, what you'll find is that they are, for the most part, partisan and just don't want to admit it. They have their own ideologies. There are certain issues where they will always fall in line with one of the major parties. In fact, the majority of issues, they will fall in line with one of the major parties. And there'll be one or two where they don't. So they decide to be independent or unaffiliated, but they're basically the same as everyone else, except on paper. So keep that in mind as you consider this. Centrism is different than independence and even moderate political beliefs. Centrism is an ideology, and it's a near obsession with, well, you know, the center. This idea that somehow if you can bring the best ideas of both sides together at all times, you'll always end up with the greatest solution. And what you can see, if you look through the legislative history of this country, is what we ended up with centrism. Anytime there's been a lot of centrist melding between the two parties, we've ended up with a lot of corporatism. We've ended up with a lot of baby steps towards progress and solutions. We've ended up with a lot of shoring up of status quos, most of it with a real racist lean because the centrists are almost always white. That is the actual history. If you look at American political history from a legislative perspective, and it stands out. So keep that in mind as we talk about this, too. The question really remains, are the parties relevant at this point, heading into the 2020 election or even looking back at the past few elections? Another question that remains is, obviously, for the Democrats, who is going to be the standard bearer in 2020 and how important is that? There was a time when the parties really drove things and there was not much separation between the fundraising apparatus, the party structure, and the standard bearer. This was a time when the parties literally chose the nominees. Now, there was always an election, but that's not always how it worked. Now, we're in a very different scenario. Now we're in a scenario where quite a case can be made that both major parties, when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to candidate selection, when it comes to promoting the agenda of the party during the general election, in an election cycle, quite an argument can be made that the parties are actually pretty irrelevant and don't influence elections that much, if at all, at times. Taking a look at some of the numbers from the 2016 election, Trump ended up with 14 million people, roughly, that voted in the Republican parties that voted for him. Nationwide, there were nearly 240 million Americans eligible to vote in those Republican primaries. So Trump walked away with 6% of eligible Republican primary voters. Lee Drutman, political scientist writing at Vox, contrasts this with in 2017, the German election, where there was a far right populist Alternative for Germany party with a whole slew of candidates. AfD, Drutman writes, won about 5.9 million votes of the eligible 61 million eligible voters in Germany that year. So about 10%. And he says, in short, when voters in both countries were given a full range of options, Donald Trump ended up less popular here in the United States than the far right populist Alternative for Germany was in Germany. And Drutman goes on to explore this, and he said that it can be attributed mainly to the German system, that this racist, far-right populist party and their candidates were kept out of power basically by other parties who had the option to rally together and form a coalition. Whereas in the United States, it's a choice between two major parties. Trump 6% gave him the nomination of a major party, and then at that point it was just a choice between two people for the rest of American voters in the general election. Also, Drutman points out, winning the nomination of the party legitimizes a candidate regardless of the relatively small number of people that handed them the nomination. So what Drutman's saying is that the nomination process within both parties is actually a part of this dysfunction that can propel someone as odious as Trump into a legitimate candidacy for the United States presidency. And Drutman continues, he says, you know, because he was a Republican candidate and because he wasn't Hillary Clinton, 63 million Americans cast a vote for him, catapulting him to the presidency. That's a lot of votes, right? 63 million. But if you look at the turnout in the election, in the general election, 63 million votes is 26.8% of eligible voters nationwide. 63 million Americans voting to send Republicans to the House as well in 2016, Drutman points out, and says it was also the same percentage of eligible voters there. So in many cases, he writes, these were not affirmative votes for Republicans, but votes against Democrats. That's the way a two-party system is designed to work in ways. So Drutman says in the paper that he wrote on the relevance or lack thereof of the American political parties, he says that the numbers he says point out that contrary to claims that American political parties have to appeal to a broad coalition or appeal broadly at all to win, they only need to win a quarter of the voting age population to gain unified control of the United States government. And he says a presidential nominee needs to win far less than that to gain the legitimizing power of a party's nomination. So you have two parties, two major parties. It's a small percentage of eligible voters you have to get to win the nomination for either of those parties. And he points out, too, by the way, Drutman, that he's not just picking on Republicans. He said, you know, the same kind of thing happened for Democrats in 2008. His point is that it's a small number of people that hand the nomination to a candidate for a major party. Once they have that nomination, they're legitimized and taken very seriously, at least by the media. And I would say a good majority of voters once the general election begins or at least post summer conventions. And then you have a relative to eligible voters, at least a small percentage of eligible voters actually voting in the general election as well. And unlike other governments in other countries where there a coalition can be built, if there's a candidate rising, you have these other factions and parties that can coalesce together to combat that candidate and get behind a single candidate. In America, where we only have two major parties competing, low voter turnout is a result of that, Drutman says, because in, for example, he writes again of Germany, turnout in 2017 was closer to 80%, and American voter turnout is usually in the mid-50s in presidential years, closer to 40%, he says, in midterm elections. So the point he's making, and I'll tie this in, trust me, the point he's making is that, again, a small percentage of eligible voters can get a candidate nominated. A say half of eligible voters can get a candidate elected to the presidency, and the Electoral College plays a role in that as well, because again, it can be just getting the right amount of support, as Trump did in a handful of counties in the right states, and you win the electoral votes. We've talked about that on a previous episode. So it would be too extreme to say this is a system easy to hijack, although that's kind of what Trump did. And I still kind of think it was accidental and surprised even him and his campaign. That said, this isn't a reason to tear the system down, as some want to do, although I do think eventually we're going to have to get serious about something like ranked choice voting and doing away with the Electoral College, and there are a lot of things we probably should do. The status quo, I don't think is really defensible at this point, although it's not a completely broken system. It's not as good as it could be. But back to this idea of whether or not the parties matter, and I guess more specifically to my point this week, whether or not the parties need to appeal broadly and chase coalitions of voters, as Democrats seem to have convinced themselves at some point is necessary, the evidence says no. The evidence says, as Drutman points out, any candidate, any party, down ticket or for the presidency, you only need to win a quarter on average of a quarter of the voting age population will give you the keys to government. So back again to this 1950s period when you had America's most notable and respected political scientists collectively writing a report titled Toward a More Responsible Two-Party System. They wrote this report because they were watching this happy postpartisan, pre-partisan, I don't know what you want to call it, time when both at state and local party levels, the national parties, all of this, they were getting along so well, and they were getting a lot of small things done. There were no fights over the debt ceiling. There were no really big fights over budgets. The nuts and bolts of running the country, things actually were functioning a lot better. And then along comes civil rights and the public support and this kumbaya way of governing breaks down. Basically, there is a major push for aggressive change on at least one front, and this everybody's a buddy two-party system could not absorb it. There were many attempts to move forward on a lot of different things. Programs that were publicly popular and much in need. Civil rights, as I've mentioned. Anything big, basically, was stymied. But yet, both parties were getting along. Shouldn't they, if you listen to the rhetoric of today, shouldn't both parties have been able to eke out a compromise? Find a way to sit down and be bipartisan-y, come together and unify around a solution? Well, why couldn't they? Drutman, again, has an answer. He says that instead of elections giving voters a meaningful choice between well-thought-out alternatives to pressing national political problems, voters encountered what essentially was a muddle. What happened in Washington seemed to have no connection to what happened at the ballot box. So the political scientist, Strutman said, writing this letter, saw this as an untenable situation, one that would fail, quote, to generate legitimate responses to emerging domestic and foreign problems whose scale and scope demanded strong, responsible national parties. To accomplish this, they recommended a massive centralization of the two parties so that national party leaders developed carefully researched policy alternatives, which voters could then approve authoritatively through majority vote. Put that another way, the political scientists in the 1950s said, this is great. Everyone's getting along. Everybody seems to be really enjoying themselves there in Washington, D.C. And when it comes to naming post office or appropriating funds for the military, there aren't a lot of fights. And the interviews with the media are quite boring. Things are going great. Thanks for checking in. When it comes to taking bigger steps, solving bigger problems, neither party could really put forward a substantive solution or idea because it would have gone against this bipartisan utopia they were existing in, and neither party wanted to go there. Political scientists at the time said, no, go there. We need to have a war of ideas. We need two parties that are presenting alternatives so that voters can choose, so that voters can say, well, I think the candidates of this party, I like their idea better. I'm going to vote for them. And, oh, I like the ideas of the candidates of this party. I'm going to vote for them instead. At the time, it really didn't matter. Now, we hear this again today, but it's from people that shouldn't be taken seriously. I heard it in 2016. Ah, there's not a lot of difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Well, if you can look back over the last 2 years and still think that, frankly, you're stupid. Do the Democrats have their own similar problems to the Republican Party? Yeah. Corporatism? Definitely. Obsession with status quos and not rocking certain funding-tied votes? Yeah. Democrats have the same problem. But Democrats have a problem that's unique to the Democratic Party. Republicans don't have. Republicans, as I talked about last week in the episode, do not have a problem using power. In fact, Republicans are more likely to abuse power than fail to have any ideas of how to use it. Democrats, on the other hand, get some power and immediately start chasing coalitions and broad consensus. And this plays out in everything from Democratic policy battles, the Obamacare legislative battle, where they were rolled three times by their own party members who were out chasing the Republican votes they would never get, dragging the process out nearly 7 months longer than it needed to be before a vote, and that vote ending exactly the same way it would have without that 7 months. But you had these people that party leadership didn't want to say no to, that wanted to go chase those Republican votes they weren't going to get. Is it different today? I'm afraid not. And again, I think that in this immediate time of American politics, this, not by their choice, is going to come down to a decision this year, sometime, I'm predicting early to midsummer, on impeachment. So, what is the solution for Democrats? What am I recommending here? Well, if you look at what political scientists have to say about the polarization and partisanship of today, the only thing you're going to find is that it can be damaging. And yes, there's the first extreme of the 1950s that was just impossibly impotent, but everyone was getting along. Now we're at the opposite extreme, where it's very difficult to get things done. Back to the Obama legacy, the reason Trump can undo so much of what Obama did is that Obama had to do it through executive power, and he had to try to expand executive power in order to do at least a handful of those things, something that none of us should really be excited about. Here's the one thing that I agree with Utah Senator Mike Lee on. Congress hasn't been doing its job, and that's led to an expansion of the executive branch, or at least an expansion of testing the waters on executive branch power again and again and again, a little mission creep, if you will, in the executive branch for decades. But Congress not doing its job, by the way, that's the only thing I agree with Senator Lee on, because he follows that up just a week later with, well, Congress should look at the Mueller report and say, this is the end of the road. Move on. Congress isn't doing its job, but I don't think Congress should do its job. I'm Senator Mike Lee. Please buy my history book. Don't, by the way. Don't. This is an important time for the Democratic Party. And I don't mean to be hyperbolic in any way. We've had many important times before, and sometimes the Democratic Party has nailed it. Sometimes they've punted. Sometimes they've face planted. Same for the Republican Party. I'm not saying this is the time and there will never be another. I'm saying this is an important time for the Democratic Party heading into the 2020 elections, not only with the consideration of how and with who that election is driven, but also a consideration for what this party is all about and what this party is going to do at this specific time. So my proposed solution, let me preface it by saying at one point I was one of these people that you'll still hear out there today, saying that some of the best things that have happened in this country came when both major parties could come together, at least legislatively, and with a, in a bipartisan fashion, eke out a solution. And that is still somewhat true. But some of the most bold and transformative legislative battles and eras in American history were extremely polarized, were extremely partisan and got pretty ugly. So I don't think we should be afraid of that. And I don't think we should be fetishizing the 1950s bipartisan get-together that Congress had become. I don't think we should be chasing this elusive, quote, independent moderate center in the American electorate. They aren't there. And if for the few that are there, they've made up their mind. They're only independent on paper. Be who you are. It's the most cliche self-help book bullshit you can find. But it's exactly what the Democratic Party needs to do. They need to figure out what exactly they are about. And that is going to involve some tough conversations when it comes to the corporate influence over American politics and the funding of campaigns. And that's just one can of worms that will have to be opened. But figure out who you are as a party and then be that party. And unfortunately, today, what that's going to mean, here is the harsh reality. And again, I was one of these people once. I remember saying to, anyone who would listen or ask me, that I didn't want as I watched the Republicans in the Obama years, I remember saying to people, I don't want to see the Democratic Party go the same way. Yeah, they should maybe to combat it, but I hope they don't. I hope they let the Republicans get this out of their system and get their asses handed to them in the election. And then we go back to normal. Then we go back to a status quo of the parties functioning more like we're used to. But that was dumb. And there are still too many out there pushing that same idea. But we've seen enough to know that is a horrible way forward. Because what happened is voters didn't punish the Republican Party. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And it looks like one of those reasons is not that voters don't have a problem with what the Republican Party has done through the Obama years and in the first few of Trump's. They're not fans of it. They don't support it. But it's not causing the blocks that turn out for Republicans to stop doing so. It's not causing the right-leaning, quote, independents to become left-leaning, quote, independents. This is coming down to the most basic of things again and again and again. And it's so obvious it boggles me that anyone, including myself, could forget it. Turnout, your base, and a little extra. Go back to Drutman and what it takes to win unified control of the United States government. Under 30% of the voting age population. That's it. Now, granted, it's under 30% in the right areas, and that requires the right candidates, and that does require the right message. So the parties aren't entirely irrelevant here. But the idea that the Democratic Party needs to go out and seek this mythical broad voting bloc coalition is absolutely ridiculous. What Democrats need to do is exactly what I would have said they shouldn't do just 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. What Democrats need to do is embrace power. Democrats need to match the extremism of the Republican Party today with their own forceful condemnation, for lack of a better word, of exactly what the Republican Party has become. To put it more crassly, Democrats need to go out there and use every bit of power they can eke out and every bit of money they can siphon from the electoral cycle to hand Republicans their asses. Now, I'm not saying all norms and respect for institutions should be out the window. What I'm saying is that Democrats need to stop worrying about building some mushy, mythical center that will turn out for them in elections. And they need to go out there and fight. And they need to go out there and make sure that their base, which they don't know right now what it is, comes out. They're angry. They're looking for an alternative. And not just to Trump. They're looking for an alternative to our tax policy. They're looking for an alternative to an economic system. There is economic anxiety out there. A lot of it. It's not why Trump won. It's not why these people came out to vote for him. I mean, it is and it isn't. But the reality is there were a lot of people in this country that were okay enough with the racism. That should be disappointing. There are a lot of these people in this country right now that actually like what Trump is saying. Sure. And Democrats are smart enough to know that those people probably aren't their voters. I hope. Sometimes, Cory Booker, you make me nervous. But I think overall, Democrats know those aren't their voters. Even the most conservative Democrat in the most purple or even red of states knows that their base is important. What Democrats don't understand is that when they go out and talk about bipartisanship, when they go out and talk about finding this mythical voting block that includes a bunch of people who went out and were okay enough with the racism in 2016 to vote for Trump, that somehow Democrats can be Democrats, that somehow Democrats can inspire their base and woo those voters? Nah. And I think most importantly, there's an issue of principle here to a large extent. Now, we have to be careful about that because oftentimes when you hear somebody say this is an issue of principle, the next thing you're going to hear is something really stupid. 2010 and the Tea Party wave was, well, basically that in a nutshell. But I think there is a real principle here that matters. And in some ways, Trump is right in front of Democrats and the rest of the country embodying it. But it is something that has existed like a cancer in the American right for a long time. And it manifests itself in many ways. Racism, sexism, fear of change, xenophobia, homophobia. All of these things can be boiled down to, I mean, ironically, not ironically at all, difficult to extrapolate. This is part of what pulls a person to the right. It's unavoidable. But these ideas need to die. These points of view need to die, not just to better Democrats' electoral chances, but because it's the right thing to do. And if the Democratic Party isn't going to go out there and stomp on this, if the Democratic Party is afraid to say, a lot of people seem to be okay with the racism when you voted for this guy, if they're afraid to pick that fight and the hundreds of others like it, then what is the Democratic Party for? It's not enough to say Trump is awful. It's not enough to say that Trump needs to go. It's not enough to hope and cross your fingers that Republicans won't be able to propel him into the presidency a second time. It's not enough. It might be enough. You might get lucky. But from a perspective of principle and what's important and who we are as a country, it's not enough. This needs to be beaten. And not, in my opinion, just in the electoral cycle. Democrats, again, are going to be forced into a box this year where they have to say definitively whether or not they're going to move ahead with the impeachment process. They're not getting out from underneath that one. If they've put their ducks in a row and played their cards right between now and that time, I think it'll be pretty obvious which decision is the one that needs to happen. But what I'm afraid of is that Democrats don't know that they're headed to that cliff. And that Democrats don't know how important it's going to be that they make a stand of some kind for good reason before they go out in 2020 and ask people to hand them more power. And as much as I hate oversimplifications and their overuse in our political analysis, thank you, cable news, there's a huge oversimplification here that is amazingly descriptive of everything I've just talked about. And it goes like this. Just last weekend, Trump's having a rally. Trump says at the rally, Democrats support murdering babies. And then he goes on in detail. He says, the baby is born. The mother meets with the doctor. They take care of the baby. They wrap the baby beautifully. Then the doctor and the mother determine whether or not they will execute the baby. The crowd at the rally boos. I mean, who wouldn't boo that, right? We know it's bullshit. He knows. Well, maybe. He probably knows it's bullshit. He's not a bright guy. Most of the people in that room, I think, know it's bullshit. Elected Republicans, sure as hell, know it's bullshit. No one says a word. And if Democrats are going to turn to voters in 2020 and say, that party that, if not explicitly backing words like that and bullshit like that, they might have a point, and we should try to meet them halfway. Bipartisanship, y'all. Vote for Democrats. If that's the plan, we're all screwed. Democrats need to find a way to point to that. The baby is born, the mother meets with the doctor, and they decide whether or not to execute the baby. The president said, paying no price really in the media or with his own party, and in 2020, probably not with the voters that like him. And this is just one example of the three or four you can find every day. And even worse, it's not just the president. You can find a handful each week from congressional Republicans. It's not enough to say they're lying. It's not enough to say that isn't correct. It's not enough to say, oh, we all know that's not true. It's just campaign rhetoric. No, that doesn't cut it. Because, Democrats, you're going back out. And you're saying, give us power because we don't do things like that. But we do think that these people might have something to contribute, and so we should always try and meet them halfway. Bipartisanship, vote for Democrats. That's the message. So, people we can ignore. Final list here. Centrists. They are not the most reasonable people in the room. They're just ideologues like anyone at a Tea Party rally was. Or anyone at a Bernie Sanders rally was. Don't scream at me. I'm not trying to make an equivalence there. I'm saying that this is just ideology. But we talk about centrists as if they are somehow unique. We talk about centrists as if they have tapped into something important and worthwhile, when actually they're just that loser that's out there on Twitter right now loudly proclaiming they've never watched Game of Thrones or seen a Marvel movie. The forced contrarian wanting attention for just having bad judgment. That's a That's the average centrist. Ignore them. Moderates. Moderates have their thing to do. Moderate voters, there's a reason they're moderate. You're not changing that. No message you come up with is going to change what they do at the ballot box. Believe it or not. Independents don't exist. Only on paper. If you look at every independent, every unaffiliated voter, just like the guy out there tweeting that he's never watched Game of Thrones and judges those who do, probably reads a lot about Game of Thrones. And has probably actually watched a few episodes and probably actually likes it. He just wants to be special. That's the independent voter. That's the unaffiliated voter. They found a reason at a certain point to, on paper, cut ties with the major parties. But if you look at their voting behavior, and if you ask them what they think issue by issue, you'll notice a pattern start to develop in which they fall in line with the major parties just as much as the majority of registered partisan voters do. So take those three out of the picture and come back again and again to this idea that Democrats are going to not only do well in the election, but rescue this country from the sinking ship it currently is. That might be hyperbole, but I don't know if you looked around. It's kind of a mess out there politically. But the message, again, is that you're going to turn to voters and say, we need to find bipartisan solutions. We need unity. We need to bring all sides together in a war of ideas to solve the problems facing us today. Meanwhile, the standard bearer of the Republican Party is over there at a rally saying mothers are meeting with doctors and deciding, flipping a coin, I guess, on whether or not they'll execute their baby, and Democrats want that to be legal. Be ready for this fight. Have this fight. Start this fight. Bipartisanship is literally saying that these people have a point and we should try to meet them halfway. No. I'm Jason Williams. And I'll see you next week.